This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel. And today, my guest is Dr. Lucy Frimlova. She has written a book called Queer Roma, which is published by Routledge 2021 as part of the Transforming LGBTQ Lives series. The book is open access. Welcome, Dr. Frimlova, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for this opportunity and for giving visibility to the topic and to the book. I really appreciate it, especially within this podcast and, you know, the great work that you have been doing.
Of course. And it's my pleasure. I want to introduce our listeners to you. So Dr. Lucy Frimlova is an independent researcher who works at the interface between academia, social movements, and policy. Her close-up transdisciplinary research focuses on ethnic, racial, sexual, and gender identities, particularly in relation to queer Roma. In her innovative theoretical approach, she combines intersectionality with queer theory. The book Queer Roma, which we'll talk about today, is recently out with Routledge, and her article LGBTIQ, Roma and Queer Intersectionalities, The Lived Experiences of LGBTIQ Roma was published by European Journal of Politics and Gender in 2019. It won the EJPG 2021 Best Article and the Council for European Studies Gender and Sexuality Research Best Article Award 2019. Her article, I should mention, Non-Romani Researcher Positionality and Reflexivity, Queering One's Privilege, was the most read article published in Critical Romani Studies Journal. This was 2019, Volume 1, Number 2. So we have a lot of things to talk about with this wonderful book that I just finished reading, the product of really over 20 years of research. I want to start with a question about Roma, and this is really a question, Lucy, that you ask, you pose yourself in the book. Who are the Roma? And how did you come to research the topic?
Thank you very much, Stephen. I think it's a question that, many people ask and also many people don't ask. I will first start by saying that I grew up in what was then communist Czechoslovakia, I was born in 1977. And I recall that even as a school-age child, you know, I kind of took notice of Roma, even though at that time, you know, I couldn't really understand all the dynamics, but I could see that, for instance, one of my classmates was treated differently, not just by, you know, the other children, but also by teachers. And it was one of my first sort of realizations, although I couldn't really process it at the age of 7 or 8 years old. So, you know, it's just something that I've always seen. As a child, I couldn't, I can't recall being able to, you know, oppose some of the dynamics. But with this particular girl, I used to play the guitar, so you know, my way of relating was, for instance, you know, like, taking the guitar to school or something, which, you know, sounds probably crazy, but, you know, I also had a very good teacher at the time who taught me some Roma songs. So that was my way of communicating, even though I don't know, you know, how she saw it at the time. And it certainly didn't change anything about how she got treated. But as I got older, and I will say that particularly after 1989, which is a well-known fact that, you know, all the kind of racist prejudice resurfaced in the 1990s, especially with the kind of newly gained freedom, including freedom of speech. It's something that I touch upon in the book as well, that, you know, none of the governments really were able to tackle this properly, you know. So what my generation recalls as the beautiful 1990s, you know, the time of freedom and democracy, was actually not such a good time for most Roma. And I think it's something that we need to remember, you know, that there were also victims when it comes to, you know, whether we consider, you know, the kind of economic transition that saw so many people lose their jobs, and mainly Roma, who were the first ones to be let go. But also the kind of literal victims of racism, xenophobia, and anti-Gypsyism, which was shooting through the roof at the time. So it's something that you know, I have always been aware of, and I think that's how, you know, I just wanted to know more. And as a non-Roma, it wasn't until, you know, my sort of late teens, when I spent a year studying in the UK, that I came across the work of Amnesty International. Then when I returned to the Czech Republic and started my studies at the Masaryk University in Brno, I helped to establish a local branch of Amnesty International. And it was one of the kind of main themes that really preoccupied me. And then from there, you know, I just kind of naturally transitioned to more local-based issues, specifically to do with Roma, in collaboration with local Roma organizations, such as the Association of Roma in Morava, based in Brno, the Museum of Romani Culture. So I think, you know, for me, the question, who are the Roma, is a kind of ontological question that every non-Roma should ask, but it shouldn't really stop at the question. It means also going out of your way to find out, because as non-Roma who do have privilege, I feel it is also our responsibility to make the extra effort and try and do our best in terms of stepping out of that privilege and really making connections, like meaningful connections with Roma, and making friends, you know, who are Roma, spending time with Roma. So not just some sort of like abstract research, but, you know, like everyone, you know, we are people, you know, and we connect. And that was my link to Roma, and it has always been through personal connections.
I love that way of introducing the subject, Lucy. I see this in many ways as a big story of over 20 years, really going all the way back to 1989. And the topics in covering the two marginalized groups, I see these recurrent themes that you have of acceptance and solidarity and belonging, both inside and outside, straight and gay, heteronormative, non-heteronormative. I wonder if you might talk to us a little bit about your intersectional approach. I think you have a very unique way of getting at this between cultures, I think in the plural, also between the UK and the Czech Republic. How did you come to this approach? And it is race, class, gender, many other things all at once. What is it and how do you use it for the book?
So I think, you know, when we talk of intersectionality or queer theory, these are just conceptual tools that I use in this book and in my research. But, you know, I will say that certain things were intuitive for me during the time that I did not have those tools. And I did not have those tools in terms of the kind of conceptual framework until I did my doctoral thesis, which started in 2014. I finished my degree in 2017. And obviously, I had heard of queer theory and intersectionality before then. But really to understand what it means, you know, where it comes from, the history, you know, because, for instance, intersectionality is always connected to Kimberlé Crenshaw, who coined the term back in 1989 in one of her publications and then in 1991. But the history is actually much, much longer. And, you know, it's something that I also mention in the book, and it is a well-known thing among intersectional scholars that it goes back to Sojourner Truth and her famous publication, Ain't I a Woman? So you know, the history is long, but I think I'm just trying to say that my life experiences kind of formed my approach to things. So a lot of the stuff that I ended up doing, and I really consider myself very fortunate that I have been able to do, for most of my life, I have been able to do things that I'm truly passionate about as a human being. And this kind of linking and networking across cultures, regions, continents, you know, meeting people, new cultures, and also redefining myself through that, you know, is a massive part of my life. But it has also become quite central to the research that I do and the book, Queer Roma, that we're currently discussing. So I think that's how I would describe it. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the book and your choice of chapters and the layout, its structure. I understand that you have one big methodological chapter in which you're covering a lot of Romani studies scholarship, and you know, I'm really happy to see the new publications coming out, the new series in critical Romani studies with CEU Press. Could you introduce to our listeners how you divide your chapters up? So the first one methodologically, and then the following chapters, many of which are based on your field research.
Absolutely. And I will just say that actually the book is an updated version of my doctoral thesis. Yeah, so my doctoral thesis looks roughly the same, although I will make quite clear what is new. And obviously, everything is new. The book is new as opposed to the thesis. But I want to emphasize that the structuring of the book is sort of linked to my thesis. What I want to say, and I make it quite clear in the introduction, is that the book is divided into two parts. And the first one basically is the introduction, then chapter one, which is basically a kind of conceptual framework. So it does contain a lot of theory and methodology. It is also the longest chapter, which for some may be somewhat challenging to get through. But I actually felt that that's the only way of doing it, because in my mind there was I tried to do it differently, but this was really the only way of producing the book in its current shape and form. Chapter number one really looks at. It is a kind of theoretical trajectory. It sort of maps some of the main debates in Romani studies and understanding Romani identities beyond ethnic and binary frames. And as you pointed out, it does link to my methodology. So the methodology also, it doesn't only discuss the methods that I used in order to collect the data, analyze the data, come up with the analysis that this book contains, but it also talks about my positionality as somebody who isn't Roma, who happens to be lesbian, a lesbian woman, whose position is very kind of interesting, let's put it this way, yeah? Interesting in the sense that, I have been asked a number of times, like, so how can you, as a non-Roma, how can you produce this knowledge? Why should we take it seriously? Even why should we read it? You're not Roma. And I think those are some of the questions that I pose in the book and that I also answer. I also tackle them in one of the journal articles that you mentioned that came out in Critical Romani Studies back in 2019. So it has been a massive part of conducting the fieldwork, the research, and I think I want to emphasize that we do need to think about those social and power dynamics that shape the work of researchers, but not only researchers, but also human beings. And think of the privileges. Some people don't like that word, but I always try to use the example of, for instance, the difference between being able-bodied and not able-bodied, and the kind of accommodations that are made. For instance, when you look at local infrastructure, pavements and, other sort of material things that are in place in order for those who are not able-bodied to go out, for instance, on a walk, or just to go to town, catch a bus. And I think if we, able-bodied people don't think of their ability to, walk the pavement as a privilege, but actually it is, because many, people who are not able-bodied cannot do that, you know. So I think if we think of, for instance, anti-gypsyism, homophobia, in similar terms, to many non-Roma, you know, they won't see it as a privilege. You know, those things that they do on a daily basis. Oh, I'm driving my car and all the billboards that I see have got non-Roma white people in them. And that's a taken for granted thing for them. But try to put yourself in the shoes of a Roma person. And how do you think that feels for that person? Or for an LGBT person who keeps seeing, you know, these like images of, you know, heteronormative families, when in fact we know very well that families can also be different. You know, they can be same-sex families, they can be single-parent families, you know. So those impulses that we get on a daily basis, to some, they feel completely normal, and they will not think of those experiences as a privilege. But I would encourage everyone to really kind of inspect their own position in society, and that's where that section of the chapter comes from.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that and introduce what you're arguing in many ways beyond the world of, say, pride parades, because in talking about the decriminalization of homosexuality, I think this is incredibly important as a 20th century story. But you make a lot of really interesting arguments toward the middle of the book about queer belonging and visibility. I wonder if you could introduce how you carried out your field research. I think you had 40 or so people. I mean, without naming names and things like that, could you tell us a little bit about how you carried out that field research and gathering the life stories of gay and lesbian and trans people within the Romani community?
Absolutely. You know, it is a qualitative study. Yeah. I worked with 24 participants. In the course of my fieldwork, which took place in 2015 and 2016, and the most important sections of my fieldwork actually coincided with the first and the second International Roma LGBT conferences in Prague. So, So these were venues. Very, very important ones, not just, well, let me just say that, for instance, the first LGBT Roma International Conference was so unique because it brought together a lot of people who had never met another Roma LGBT person before. And who were Roma LGBT? Yeah.
This was August 2016, right?
This was August 2015. So the first one took place in 2015, the second one took place in 2016, and I was very, very fortunate that, you know, I was able to collect data at these key events, which produced very specific dynamics. You know, I gathered data in focus groups, in two focus groups, and then also in semi-structured interviews. But not all of the interviews took place as part of the conference, because as you can imagine, conferences are very, very intense. So where there wasn't enough time, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to link with those participants, and they agreed to talk to me afterwards, either in person or over Skype or, you know, other technologies. So, you know, we were able to, in the focus groups, we talked about some of the overarching topics in relation to the lived experiences of queer Roma. You know, what are the challenges? What are, you know, some of those, because the book also, it doesn't only focus on negative things, but it also emphasizes positive experiences, empowering experiences, And I think it's very, very important to foreground those narratives, obviously not forgetting about, you know, the negative sides of oppression. But, you know, I say it very clearly at the outset of my book that it is unique, in my opinion, and the first book of its kind to offer these stories of rejection on the one hand, but also acceptance on the other. And some of those stories have actually never been told before. And I think it's really, really important for those stories to come out, because when we look at the media, the book also kind of chronologically covers the emergence of the LGBT Roma rights movement and, you know, sort of individual beacons, if you like, you know,
that's a good word. Mm-hmm.
Started popping out sort of sometime around 2008, 2009, you know, one book here, another book here, a film here, then an event there. So I try to, you know, kind of offer, and obviously, you know, I'm not claiming that I have managed to include everything and everyone, but that really was my, wish to be able to give credit to everyone and every single event that has taken place since then, to actually bring the voices of queer Roma to the foreground, and to show the incredible wealth of experiences.
Could you say also a few words about passing? I think this is a striking part of your book. And to me, in reading it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it's not just a race question or the social construction of race question, but I'm really struck by how you go beyond the kind of black and white perspective of just like anti-gypsyism and homophobia, and deal from within these communities the question of belonging, and that includes, of course, LGBTQ communities. Mm-hmm. And the relative level of acceptance. But what I mean by this question is passing both within LGBTQ communities and then within the larger society. Could you say a bit about that, and maybe if it matters which country we're talking about, if it's Bulgaria or the Czech Republic or Romania?
Sure.
Or someplace else.
Okay. So I think this is where intersectionality and queer theoretical concepts are very, very useful, because they enable us to look at people's experiences through the very same lenses. So you know, for somebody who is navigating, you know, intersectional identity or an intersection of identities, if you like, and those identities happen to be stigmatized, such as Roma ethnic identity and LGBT, IQ, sexual and gender identities. And I think that's what kind of is unique about the lived experiences of Roma, but not that unique in the sense that we soon discover that there are also other groups who have been experiencing similar intersectionalities. But passing is a strategy that has been used by many minority groups, irrespective of whether their identities are ethnic, racial, sexual, gender. And it always entails this sort of masking as the same or similar as the norm in order to escape being punished for being different or being the opposite. So sometimes, you know, it's easy, sometimes it's obvious. The lived stories that I talk about in the book offer different types of experiences depending on how well the person is able to pass or not. So it also touches upon issues such as complexion, you know, skin color, I also talk about, I bring forward those stories where, for instance, one of the participants talks about hiding in plain sight as a gay Roma, and what it entails, you know. So some of the dynamics around being openly gay and being accepted by a team of girls in that instance, not so much by his male peers, but then there is a completely different set of criteria when it comes to Roma, you know, and acceptance of Roma. In his case, he says, well, you know, I'm light skinned, so I've always been able to pass as non-Roma. It's not so sort of cut and dry, you know. So the book kind of looks at similar stories, you know, stories where, people have experienced some, you know, outrageous examples of anti-gypsism. For instance, one of the Czech participants was talking about this horrendous experience of her classmates wanting to pour bleach on her to whiten her skin, which in and of itself is an entirely unimaginable and traumatizing experience. And when she was telling me, I just thought that's I was speechless. You know, that there is nothing you can say, especially if you haven't experienced something like that. And for instance, in her case, you know, she also talks about her identity fluctuating or being fluid in terms of her sexuality, because she ends up in a relationship with a trans person who is also Roma, you know. So this kind of double story also shows the kind of becoming, the process of becoming, when it comes to our identities. And it raises some questions around, you know, identity being a process, you know, not something that is in it, given, fixed, but something that does change. And it doesn't mean that we can change our ethnic identity or racial identity. You know, I can stop being white, or a Roma person can stop being Roma. No, that's not what I'm saying. What it means is that those identities shift depending on context, relational material, and other realities that we navigate, and those realities and contexts change as we move in life. And I think, for instance, this story, of the Romani woman who thought she was straight, and then ends up being in a queer relationship with a trans Roma, I think is a beautiful example of that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. bookstagram.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask because I'm also struck by the proposals from within collectives and in communities or in communities of people with similar lived experiences for how to get beyond the ordinary, I would say maybe even normative objectification and fetishization of queer Roma. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit about how you see that objectification and fetishization even in scholarship. And this, you know, is a kind of controversial thing that a lot of scholars have addressed and talking about binaries. But with all of your experience, I kind of have to ask this question. And it's really two parts. So first, you know, in building the alliances and collectives, which you've been doing, and then secondly, in dealing with some of the persistent essentialism and racism, ethnocentrism, even within LGBTQ organizations.
Okay, so if I forget one part of this double question, please remind me. I will try to retain all the information. So in terms of scholarship, I think I have tried to do my best in terms of illustrating some of the tense points, you know, some of the issues and challenges that Romani studies have faced over time. And I also make a parallel with, you know, lesbian and gay studies and, you know, its kind of evolution over time into queer theory. But, you know, some of the more recent manifestations of this kind of trend within some inverted commas, feminist scholarships to essentialize sex and gender. And I'm specifically talking about transphobic radical feminists, you know, who have taken a very, very extreme stance and are doing a lot of the hard work that has been put into scholarship on sexuality and gender and feminism in general over the past 3-4 decades. So, you know, I'm trying to draw some parallels when it comes to this tension between constructionism and essentialism in both Romani studies and lesbian and gay studies and what it has done, you know. And I also try to kind of explain how these challenges may come about, you know. For instance, when we focus solely on oppression, and differentiation, then the kind of essentialist trend is quite understandable, yeah, because if oppression is not theorized through a lens which is more than constructionist, I think we will end up, you know, in that vicious cycle. And what, for instance, Gemson talked about back in 1995, you know, when he talked about the queer dilemma, then McGarry and Jesper talk about the identity dilemma in 2015. So we have had these dilemmas over time, and they have taken different shapes and forms in different disciplines. But at the end of the day, they were very much similar, in my opinion, and they continue to be similar. And I will say that some of the essentialization that we see around women in relation to trans women, that is, completely unacceptable in my mind. It's the same type of essentialization that Roma have been experiencing for decades. Yeah. And that's the kind of objectification as well, whether it's the media and sometimes even academia. You know, one of the participants is also a Romanist scholar, and she refers to the notion of gajology, and the fact that if we are theorizing Roma in Romanist studies, then we should also theorize gaje, non-Roma, in gajology, and it's a sort of a seriously meant joke, which points at the asymmetry when it comes to theorizing minority or what are seen as minority people or discourses, and there is this like almost like obsession with that, and I just want to clarify what I mean by that, because many of those intentions are good, but as we say in Czech, the road to health is often paved with good intentions, and I think we just cannot exclude ourselves from that, and we have to see every bit of scholarship on Roma in a particular context. And when it comes to Romani studies or the Gypsy Law Society, it does come with the legacy of essentialism and racism, and I think it needs to be questioned and challenged.
Mm-hmm. And from your interviews, I can name a lot of them. Bruno, John, you have names, I think, from your field study that you've anonymized. Could you maybe give us an idea of the big conclusions that you have? Some, I think, could be anthologized almost in a plural anthology of the many Roma cultures instead of just, sort of one homogenous experience. But what were some of the big sort of conclusions and patterns that you found from the responses? Did you find that people who were out of the closet seemed happier? Did you find this larger story of power asymmetries and dynamics to be typical? I guess there are a lot of questions I can ask, mm-hmm. but I don't want to put words in your mouth for the larger.
Yeah, it's not the easiest of questions that you're asking me, because there are so many aspects to your question and to the book. I think the overarching conclusion, one of the overarching conclusions, is that, in my opinion, the lived experiences of queer Roma and also their visual self-representations challenge a lot of the stereotypes around Roma, the kind of one-dimensional, detrimental, negative stereotypypes and the kind of stereotypical representations of Roma that we most see, Roma are quite regularly portrayed as anachronic, antithetical to modernity, somehow stuck in time, homophobic. Roma, that there is this like myth that Roma are more homophobic than non-Roma, that they don't accept their LGBT relatives. The book challenges all of those myths and all of those untruths, which are often used for political ends, it also talks about some of the racist dynamics which we see in ethnic majority societies, and unfortunately the mainstream non-Roma LGBT movement is not an exception. A lot of the rejection that LGBT or queer Roma experience also comes from within the larger movement. But again, it's not exactly a surprise because, you know, anti-Gypsyism and racism are some of the most prominent social dynamics in Europe and elsewhere. And, you know, I think the book shows quite clearly that, you know, being LGBT doesn't necessarily make you prone to understand Roma, you know, it doesn't make you somehow more sensitive. The book also shows that being Roma doesn't automatically give you the ability to understand the experiences of LGBT people. So the kind of assumption that if you come from one minority, you can actually relate to another, I think is also challenged by the book, and it shows that it doesn't work that way, you know. However, alliances can be built, and it shows some of the processes and strategies to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I mean, I think of some of the recent queer studies scholarship that's coming out on things like pinkwashing, and the idea of being more liberal, like just so, you know, to arrive at greater acceptance in society, once you've made one choice, you're somehow liberated and can empathize better with other communities that are similarly liberated. But I guess this is, you know, something as part of my last question for you to introduce some of your grassroots work. And here I mention how, you know, interesting your book is when you update it to 2020 and 2021. I'm thinking about the European Roma Grassroots Organizations Network. I'm thinking about some of the legislation that you mentioned. I'm thinking about the monitoring that goes on. Could you talk maybe like about the positive things that you see from a grassroots perspective, like what needs to be done in terms of actionable history and scholarship and ultimately policy?
Sure. I will just say that, you know, grassroots activities have been part of my research, and I would say almost like an inseparable part of my research from day one. And even the book, you know, I have said that basically most of the fieldwork took place during the two international LGBT Roma conferences, which in and of themselves were grassroots initiatives, and they produce certain outcomes which and certain outputs which are still being used today. I have also made sure that you know, the knowledge that we co-produce with the Queer Roma participants gets fed into larger networks and larger initiatives. So, for instance, you know, the Council of Europe, the European Commission, also the Roma Civil Monitor. You know, we actually had a whole kind of roundtable discussing some of the consequences. Of what has been going on in relation to, you know, this like almost like a different type of theorization of identity through understanding the experiences of queer Roma. I also mentioned towards the end of the book a recent project that I have been working on with one of the key organizations that basically made the first international LGBT conferences possible, and that's the Prague-based organization ARA ART, which is a Czech-Romani LGBT organization doing a lot of transdisciplinary intersectional work. And the project that we have been working on since last November, which is funded by the European Commission, looks at LGBT Roma in the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Slovakia. And as part of that project together with another colleague, we have produced a research study basically mapping the kind of legal provisions with respect to multiple and intersectional discrimination in those three countries and how they're able to respond or not able to respond to some of the lived experiences of queer Roma. I'm saying this to say that my sort of focus has been on translating the kind of theoretical, some might say abstract knowledge into concrete, tangible work that does make a difference on the ground. And in a previous project, which I did while I was still working in academia, I did that at the University of Portsmouth back in 2019, was looking at visual self-representations. And actually the book contains a number of photographs that LGBT Roma visual activists and artists created as part of that project. And again, it helps to visualize, not just to understand, but also to visualize the lived experiences of queer Roma.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the Aspects Gallery, right, in Portsmouth. Was that the one?
Yeah, which was, I mean, that was the combination of 12 months of work. Cool. But, you know, what went into that exhibition, and thank you for remembering that, was, you know, 10 months of work with queer Roma visual activists and artists, some of whom actually participated in the in my doctoral research. So some of their stories are also contained in the book. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, sometimes a picture speaks a thousand words, and you see a picture and you don't need, you know, a whole chapter on, queer belonging, for instance. You know, you kind of get the message almost instantly. So that was actually one of the main driving forces behind that project, to make to enhance the impact of my doctoral research, which you can read in the book.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I hope people will see all of the exhibitions that you've organized and consulted for and been a part of. I mean, I'm thinking also of the Black Lives Matter movement and how difficult it became for people to go to the theater or to go to the museum. And, you know, it was such an important issue, not just for Roma, but for other minorities, the Bila Mista I'm thinking of, for example. And I think these are really inspiring things. Thank you for all of your involvement. And now, since we're kind of running out of time, I would ask you, Lucy, since we've been talking about the chapters, all six chapters in Queer Roma, if you could perhaps recommend some research or maybe authors for our listeners here on New Books Network, what do you see interesting out there?
So, there's been actually quite a lot of research on queer Roma done over the past 10, 15 years. I would not just research, but, a lot of writing, even, in terms of, the kind of literature that is not academic. So I would definitely recommend Mikey Walsh's book Gypsy Boy and Gypsy Boy on the Run. These came out in 2009 and 2011. There's also a very, very good UK-based Romani Gypsy gay artist called Daniel Baker, who has been producing tons of art, but also a lot of scholarship around queer Roma, or what he calls the queer gypsy. And he has an article, and he also wrote a thesis about the queer gypsy. There is of course, other queer Romani scholars, the book has an extensive bibliography at the end. So you will find all of those people and all of those books there. But one key book or publication that I would recommend is called Juvliarke, Roma Lesbian Existence in Serbia, written by Vera Kurtic in 2013, published by the European Roma Rights Center. Then there are other people or other initiatives. Some actually function or operate only online. So there is an amazing project called Do Not Spit in My Face, which looks at queer Roma as well. So you just go to www.donotspitinmyface.com. And, you know, if you are interested in some more visual representations of queer Roma, you can also visit our website, which is the qrstock.qrtv.eu. And it has all the photos that we produced back in 2019 together with the queer Romani visual activists and artists. There's also, obviously, under COVID, you know, theater performances have been skewed, but an amazing play called Roma Army at the Maxim Gorky Theater in Berlin. And they have been giving shows over Europe over the past 2.5 years. So if you get a chance to see Roma Army, I can't recommend it enough. It's a theater play which was written by two sisters, Sandra and Simodida, and they are they both live in Vienna. They are of Serbian Romani heritage, and the play contains a lot. You know, it kind of speaks to their intersectional experiences as, and one of the sisters is actually a lesbian Roma. So it contains a lot of information and kind of is very conducive to contemplations around identity, sexual identity, gender identity, ethnic, racial identity, all those things that I also discuss in the book. There are so many. I would also mention Dejo Mate, who is a young Romani scholar writing about queer Roma, LGBT Roma, and intersectionality. Arman Halic, who has written about this sort of turn in this queer turn in theater. And you know, this sort of future of European culture being very much Roma and queer. It's called The Revolution Is Here and Now. The revolution is Roma, queer, and feminist. So yeah, there are many, many things, and I'm also emphasizing the kind of non-academic stuff.
Yes, because, please.
Yeah, because really? it's not always readily available, but there has been a lot. My book, you know, if you go to the reference section, it contains all those references, including links to videos and so on and so forth. I will also mention one very important website. I've already kind of made a reference to our visualizing the lives of LGBT Roma and the link that goes with it. But if you want to check out the Queer Roma TV, qrtv.eu, it's a kind of multimedia platform run by Laszlo Farkas, who runs a television, a radio station, and does all sorts of podcasts and other...
fabulous.
Yeah. Other sort of streaming events.
Fantastic. And you know, the bibliography is really extensive. So this is another reason for people to read the entire book. Thank you. And finally, this is the last 60-second question. What are you working on now?
So I'm wrapping up the project in Hungary, Czech Republic, and Slovakia. And I'm starting to work on an article which actually will talk about visualizing the lives of queer Roma and the photographic visual representations and self-representations that we produced back in 2019.
Excellent. Well, I thank you, Dr. Lucy Fremlova, for being with me here today. This was a really wonderful interview and for covering so much ground in your book, which I would really highly recommend to an audience here.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Queer Roma, and it is published by Routledge Open Access 2021 as part of the Transforming LGBTQ Lives series. Thank you, Lucy, so much for being on the podcast with me today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Stephen. I really appreciate it.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here at New Books Network. Until next time.